Good afternoon, I guess, still. I heard a story once about a college professor that stood before his class on the first day of classes and said, "Nobody sleeps in my class." And the students noticed that he had a tendency to toss a tennis ball up in the air and bounce it on the floor when he was walking around lecturing. And two or three days into the semester, sure enough, from way up, about halfway up the auditorium, they heard. And the professor stopped and took aim right off the kid's forehead. Woke him up, and the professor again restated the obvious, "Nobody sleeps in my class." And the next class period, he had a baseball. I'm unarmed. Okay, but after that second excellent meal, and if you had hosts like we did, third excellent meal of the day, you are probably as sleepy as I am. So I promise not to take any cat naps today if you don't. Alcohol, drugs, pornography, gambling, cheating, lying, sexual immorality, modern idolatry, and anything else that you want to add to that list that I don't have time to mention, that are modern-day thorns in our flesh. Now that phrase, thorn in the flesh, is taken from Paul talking about a physical problem that he had. And while it is true that physical ailments that we seem to endure on a daily basis do affect us spiritually from time to time, I was asked to speak mostly of those things that tend to draw us away from focus on God. Things that on a daily basis seem to get in the way, and what to do about them. How do we deal with all this temptation around us? How do we deal with everything that the world seems to be throwing at us at once? You know, I've often wondered, surely in the time of Paul, when we hear him talk about the fiery darts of the wicked one, I always used to picture, you know, one dart right through the air. Well, there was a group of us last night that got together and played dodgeball. And there's something about dodgeball. If there's just one ball coming at you, you've got a pretty good chance of getting out of the way. But if there's three or four coming all at once, it's a little more difficult to dodge. The chances of getting hit go up. And sometimes, if you're like me, when you're out amongst the world, you don't have just one little dart coming at you. It's like Satan has a whole fistful in both hands and just starts chucking. And here they come, one right after another, and sometimes four or five or even more, all at the same time. So how do we overcome these temptations, these things that are in the world? Well, the first thing I want to do is take you to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. And we're going to look at verses 13 and 14 and 15 for just a minute. James writes, "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren." Now I want us to picture this. I'm going to use the board. The first thing he says that happens is that we have a desire. So that's the first thing I'll put up here, desire. We have something within us that wants to do something. Now, there are all kinds of different desires. There are desires that are innately good, the desire of a man to look after his family, The desire of a husband to love his wife, those are innately good. We have desires that are innately bad. And we have desires that can kind of go either way, depending on the situation. The physical relationship between a man and his wife is a good thing. The physical relationship between two people that are unmarried is a bad thing. So it could go either way, depending on the situation. But we have these desires within us. But notice that it's not the desire itself that James says is sinful. The way he puts it is that he says when desire has conceived. Now he's using the example of the birth process, but I want to put a little different word up there other than conceived, because for us in our day-to-day life, I think what James is trying to get across is this. Opportunity. The opportunity to act on those desires. See, if we have the desire to do something we know we shouldn't do, and we don't have the opportunity to act on that desire, there's really no problem at the moment. Other than we better get that desire quenched. We'll talk about that a little more in a second. Because if we continually think about that desire, if we ponder that desire, if we plan for that desire, if we wonder about that desire, that I think is what James is getting to with the idea of when desire has conceived. And when we give that desire opportunity, what does James say happens? The next thing that happens is that that equals sin. We have taken two things and combined them and made something that's not good. Made something that is appalled in the sight of God. When desire and opportunity come together. If I have the desire to get high on some drug, and I stay away from any source of that drug, I still have the desire, but I'm not sinning with that desire. But if I go to the area where I know I can get my hands on that particular drug, now I'm giving myself opportunity. I'm putting myself in a situation where I have the ability now to sin because I have let the desire and the opportunity come together. I have added those two together and come up with sin. And James tells us that if we allow that process to continue, we have to move from math to science for a second, produces death. If we continue in that desire and in that giving that desire opportunity, it will destroy me. It may destroy me physically, depending on what it is, but it will definitely destroy me spiritually, piece by piece. Desire plus opportunity equals sin, which produces death. And the question we're trying to get at is, what can I do about all that stuff that's in the world that I shouldn't be a participant in? What am I supposed to do when I have the desire to do something I shouldn't do? Well, the easiest thing that I can see is to change that. That's the easiest thing I can see to do. Over time, I can push down and get rid of, in part, hopefully entirely, that desire to do that thing. That's the ultimate that God wants us to have. Remember, Jesus said, even if you hate somebody in your heart, it's a sin. Eventually, I don't even want my mind to go there. But in order to quench that desire, in order to push it away, I have to get away from the actual sin that the desire is linked to. Which means I have to change the opportunity. Now, this seems like an obvious thing to us, but many times we are tripped up when we fall for the same tricks that Satan throws at us every single time. every single time. He knows what is going to trip us up. He knows what's going to affect me, and He knows what's going to happen when I am placed in a situation where I have the opportunity to act on some desire that I have within me. If I can eliminate that opportunity, it takes me a long way towards conquering that sin and toward quenching that desire. Now, there's all kinds of desires and opportunities that we could talk about, but the eldership asked me specifically to speak to the concept of gambling. So I'm going to do that for just a moment. Gambling is one of those things that Satan probably... No, not probably. It's one of those things that Satan knows he can trip us with. Because it's one of those seemingly innocuous things. It's no big deal. It doesn't really hurt anybody, right? All those things that we say about every other sin that we commit, that one just seems to be able to catch us in a different way. I think one of the things that I'm talking about is brought out in Psalm 64, if you want to turn there. Psalm 64, and I'm going to start reading in verse 1. David writes, "Hear my voice, O God, in my meditation. Preserve my life from fear of the enemy. Hide me from the secret counsel of the wicked, from the insurrection of the workers of iniquity, who sharpen their tongue like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, bitter words, that they may shoot in secret at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear. They encourage themselves in an evil matter. They talk of lying snares secretly. They say, 'Who will see them?' They devise iniquities. We have perfected a shrewd scheme. Both the inward thought and the heart of a man are deep." David's prayer here to the Almighty is to protect me from those that are laying traps for me, for those that are doing things that they know are going to damage me and they don't seem to care. And they do it in such a way that it hides the danger from me. That it hides the danger from me. I want to give you an example of what I think I mean by hiding the danger from me. When you think about the big state lotteries that are going on all over the U.S. now, I don't think there's a state that doesn't participate anymore. These huge lottery numbers, and you see all these winnings, and you see all these people that have won, and you drive through and there's billboards, and you go to the store and there's signs, "We sold a ticket that won this much money," right? What they don't tell you, I found a really cool math site on the internet that allows you to calculate the odds of just about anything. And so I put in there that I wanted to know what the odds were of winning a lottery where there you had to pick 7 numbers correctly. Now, you didn't have to get them in the right order, just any 7 numbers. And the numbers available were 1 to 99. The odds of getting all 7 numbers that were picked in a lottery for 1 through 99, and I'm going to have to look at this because I can't remember this number, is this. That's your odds of winning that lottery, of picking those 7 numbers. That number, if I remember my math right, is 14,887,031,544 out of 1. You got one chance of that. What that chance means is you've got to buy that many lottery tickets to be sure you're going to win. Because there's that many possible combinations of numbers. Now, let me put that in a little bit of perspective, because that was a number that was way too big for me to comprehend. You have approximately about a 1 in 2 million chance to be struck by lightning. I know we have several women around that are expecting. I hate to inform you of this, But you have a 1 in 705,000 chance of having quadruplets. How many sets of quadruplets do you see walking around? And yet your chances are that much greater of having quadruplets than they are of winning the lottery. In fact, how many like oysters? Anybody else like oysters? I like oysters. Not too many people eat green snotty things, apparently. Well, oysters make pearls, right? You have a 1 in 12,000 chance of finding a pearl inside an oyster. That means you are 124,058 times more likely to find a pearl in an oyster than you are to win the lottery. If I were you, I'd just start eating more oysters. I still had trouble getting my hands around that, so this website gave me this analogy as well, and I really liked this one. Take a string of rope, a length of string or rope, that's 1,257 feet long, and make a big circle. Now that circle is going to be about 400 feet in diameter. Okay? And if I paste it off fairly accurately, that's about 4 to 5 times as long as this auditorium. So imagine a circle that would hold 4 of these auditoriums end to end. You make that big circle, and somewhere in that circle, you take a grain of sand, and you put it in that circle. Then you pick up another grain of sand, and you blindfold yourself, and you have a friend walk you around the circle and turn you in circles and spin you all around, and they stop you, and you walk around and find another spot inside that circle while you're blindfolded, take your hand 1 foot above the ground and drop that grain of sand, and that is the chance that you have of hitting the other grain of sand. But what does the world try to tell you? It's easy. Anybody can win the lottery. Everybody wins the lottery. See, this person won the lottery. That person won the lottery. This group won the lottery. These people split the lottery. We had 6 winners this time. The odds were so good. They encourage themselves in an evil matter. They talk of laying snares secretly. They say, who will see them? Who's going to notice? They don't tell you this, do they? They don't give you that information. They devise iniquities. We have perfected a shrewd scheme. The money for the lottery in Kansas is supposed to go to schools. It's supposed to go to schools. They sold the lottery in Kansas. I don't know if any other states did this, but in Kansas they sold the lottery that a certain percentage of the proceeds were supposed to go to helping the schools. In the school district that we live in, lottery sales have gone up over the last year, depending on which figure you look at, 15 to 18%. But our school made cutbacks like I've never seen this year. They didn't hire back help. People retired and they just passed the classes off to other teachers. We used to have, in our three all-day kindergarten classes, we used to have 3 aides, 1 for each class, and now we've got 2 that run back and forth. But the lottery money went up. We have perfected shrewd schemes. 1 Peter chapter 4. In 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 10, Peter tells us, as each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Now, which is being a better steward with my money? Taking this kind of a chance or helping somebody that needs help? Putting that into the collection plate so that the elders can make sure it gets to somebody in the congregation that needs it. which is being the better steward. You know, the thing about gambling, it doesn't matter if it's the lottery or it's the poker table or it's blackjack or any other game that you can think of in a casino or at your friend's house or at your neighbor's house or down the block. It doesn't really matter what the game of chance is that you're spending your money on. There's a real good chance that it can very quickly become an addiction. Just like anything else that we do that we shouldn't do. You know, our human brains work in a certain way that when we do something that's a little exciting, we get a rush of adrenaline and several other different chemicals within our brain, within our body, that make us desire to do that again. Over and over and over. It's just how we're made up. Now, there's good things about that. We had the verse mentioned earlier by Rick. Don't be drunk with wine, which is in dissipation, but be filled with what? The Holy Spirit. I should become addicted to being around the brotherhood. I should be addicted to being at services. I should be addicted to studying. I should have that same rush when I'm doing something good. Because if I do, then I will become desirous to do that. But when we do something, especially when we do something we know we shouldn't do and we think we got away with it, oh, now there's a rush. Then the endorphins really kick in. Then the adrenaline starts, and then I got away with it. I can do that again. And an addiction can come in any form, can't it? We think of all the big ones: alcohol, drugs, tobacco, gambling, sexual immorality, all the other things. But think about books, or movies, or TV, work, our schedule. Do we become so addicted to things that we can't function? Let me give you in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul brings up a concept. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 12. He says, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. You know, did you ever think about there's some things we can do that aren't in and of themselves bad, but yet they don't really help us out too much? He goes on and says, all things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Paul was determined that there wasn't anything going to control him or dictate how he was acting or living or thinking or behaving except God and His Spirit and His Son and the Word. That's what he was going to be addicted to. That's what he was going to boast in. That's what he was going to focus on. There are four signs, and I've given these in a lesson before, so some of you may have heard these, but I want to give them again. There are four signs that you are becoming addicted to something. Because I think it's important for each one of us, as we self-examine, to understand, are we becoming under the power of something? The first one is, it takes precedent in your life over other things. It becomes the most important thing. It slowly works its way through your priorities and becomes more and more important. The second thing is, you are unable to control the frequency or duration of the activity. You get to the point where you want to do it so bad. You want to be involved in that so desperately that you can't even control that desire anymore. This isn't even in your mind anywhere. It's gone. The third sign is that you become mentally or physically unbalanced or out of control if you're unable to participate in it. You get agitated. You can't think straight. You can't focus because all you can think of is that. Whatever it is. You just aren't going to be able to go to sleep unless you find out who won on that TV show. Who is America's Best Idol? That's an interesting name for that show, isn't it? What happened on that series of shows I'm watching? I'm not going to be able to sleep unless I find out. The fourth thing is, during the activity, you unreasonably lose track of time and/or the reality around you. You don't know how long you've been there doing that. And you don't know what happened while you were there. Since I was asked to speak to this specific topic, I'm going to go back to it a second, because this event is always, always stuck in my mind from college. When I was in college, I was living in the dorm, and there was a couple of guys two floors down that on over spring break, we had the week of spring break, and they were doing some other things, but on the Thursday of spring break, one of them's father was flying them out to Vegas and putting them up in a motel and gave them some spending money, and they were supposed to just have a good time. Well, we all got back and they weren't there on Monday. And on Tuesday they weren't there. Finally on Wednesday they showed up. And here's what had happened to them. They'd never gambled before. They'd never been inside the casino before. They'd never done anything like that before. And they sat down and they got to losing, and they thought they'd win it back, and they lost some more, and they thought they'd win it back. And so they started charging some to their room, thought they'd win it back. Then they cashed in their plane tickets, thought they'd win it back. And on Sunday evening, they had to call the one guy's dad and tell them what had happened, because they had no way to get out of Vegas, and their hotel room was up. So Dad wired them some money that they were supposed to spend the night Sunday night and get on the plane the next morning and fly back. And they were sure they could win it all back. They didn't even sleep in the motel, if my understanding was right. They slept in their car because they didn't want to spend the money on a motel. They wanted to try to get it all back. They lost complete track of reality, complete track of time, and completely lost their ability to reasonably think about anything. They did finally get back, but they brought a bus, and Dad wasn't too happy. You know, whether or not something is an addiction, it could still be an idol in our life. Even if there's something out there that pricks us like a thorn, and we're not addicted to it per se, it can still become so important that it becomes an idol. How much do you plan and save and scrimp and hide and focus on the money you need for that ticket, that set of chips, that deck of cards, those slot machine quarters? Versus how much you spend and save and focus on how much you're going to give on Sunday. Or how much you are going to spend on your family. Or how much you're going to give to that neighbor down the road that doesn't have enough to eat. See, even if it's not necessarily an addiction, it could still become an idol. It could still become so important to me that I forget about my responsibilities toward God. In 1 Corinthians 10, there's what I think is one of the most powerful verses in the Bible as far as helping us deal with temptation and snares and thorns that we run into. Paul writes in verse 13 of 1 Corinthians 10, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." That's a very powerful passage because it tells me everything I need to know about getting away from something that's going to trip me up. First of all, it tells me that I'm not the first person to have to deal with this. If you are having a problem with an addiction, or you are having a problem with a continual sin, or you are having a problem with something in your life that is getting in the way and in between you and God, there's a lot of people that have dealt with that before. And there's a lot of people that have overcome that. And if they did with the power and the help of God, so can you. So don't give up. Just get to work. Just make the changes you need to make. And here's the first one. The first one, he says, is he's not going to allow me to be tempted beyond something that he thinks I can handle. So if I'm facing some temptation in my life, or I'm facing some thorns that are coming at me, or some snare that Satan continually lays for me, God knows that I can handle it. God knows that I can overcome that. Now, I can't do it by myself. He knows I need His help. I may not have figured that out yet, but He knows it. And with His help, God knows I can overcome it. And my experience looking through this book, if God knows something can be done, it gets done. It is possible. All things are possible through Christ. But then notice the end. But with the temptation, we'll also be able to make the way of escape. See, to me, that's the key right there. Yeah, other people have dealt with it. Yes, God thinks I can overcome this with His help. And the way He helps me overcome it is He finds me a way out. But there's something about this way out, if you'll indulge another story. When I was growing up on raising cattle and stuff in Kansas, we didn't have, well, they didn't have four-wheelers at all, but we didn't have a three-wheeler, and we didn't have any horses. So when it came time to round up the cattle out of the big pasture, we would make this little pen. Okay, hold on. The whiteboard's the pasture, okay? Hang with me. And this is a pen that we would set up to catch the cattle in. And this is called a squeeze chute because it slowly gets them closer together and they can't get back out. Doug's job, Dad would get the cattle in the, he'd get in the pickup, run around in the center and get them running. My job was to follow behind and run all the way around and chase them. And chase them up into this chute. And when they get into that chute, they get into the pen. And then we could close the gate. But there was one cow that my grandpa Twaddell always despised the most. And he called her the old lead cow. And it was not a term of endearment. Because what she would do is she would recognize she'd been around the block a few times. And she'd seen this trick before. And she would get into the pen. Some of you that have raised cattle are already laughing. She'd start running the fence. What was she doing? She was looking for a way out. And there could be the smallest. We could have worked on that fence for a week. And she'd find the flaw. Out she'd go. Guess where everybody else went? Right behind her. Then we'd fix that hole and Doug got to run the pasture again. Take two. But we found something out. That's why we're smarter than cows. If we would put a little salt block fresh bale of nice alfalfa hay, some sort of cow candy. That old cow would hit that pen, go straight for that. That fence could have been horrible and it didn't really matter. And see, Satan is wise to the ways of the world. And he knows if he can get us in the chute and get us up in there and get us to see that candy, see that desire, see that thing in the center of that pen, he's got us. We're stuck. We're trapped. We're going to lose. We don't care about anything else because we got our hands on that. Yeah. What God is telling us here is he wants us to be fence runners. When we start noticing that we're getting trapped and we're getting weaseled into something, we're getting crushed in and we're getting caught and we're getting trapped in that noose, he wants us to start finding the way out. And he has promised that Satan cannot make a fence that can contain us if we want out. But we have to start looking for it. We have to find the way of escape. And trust me, Satan is not going to allow it to have a big flashing sign that says exit here. And it's not always going to be the easiest to get through. Sometimes that cow would get cut up pretty bad trying to get through that fence. But she'd make it. And sometimes us getting out of a situation requires us to be pretty bold, pretty courageous, pretty forward, pretty blunt. We might even hurt some people's feelings and we might even lose some friends and we might even lose a little respect from the people around us. But we'll be out. We'll be free. And God will have provided a way out. So when those thorns start pinching in, when the temptations of this world start crushing around, Paul's suggestion is to start running the fence. Ignore the candy. Start running the fence. And then next time, don't get ourselves in that situation. Avoid that opportunity. Because they're laying traps for us. And they don't want us to know how dangerous they are. But God is trying to help us get away.